Welcome to this week's Made in Scotland podcast, sponsored by Ogilvy Ross. I'm Gary Robinson. This week's guest, I'm going to read from the back of her newly published book, if I may, Mary Weir. Welcome to the studio, incidentally.
Thank you.
Born on a farm in the 1920s, growing up through the Depression of the 1930s, the Second World War. In this book, Mary, you trace your 9 decades of a change in a life lived to the full. And I know that before we started recording, you were touching on some of that. It's an absolute pleasure to have you here on the podcast.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a fascinating story that you've written. 9 decades is a fairly long time to go through the old memory banks from childhood through to where you are now. How did you find writing the book in terms of thinking of the memories? Did they come to you quite quickly and clearly?
Yes, well, one of my own family suggested that I should write a story of my book because it was history. Over the period of 90 years as a history. So I started, and I had picked up references and stories as I've gone along from various people who influenced me in my journey through life.
And the book is called The Times of My Life, with a lovely picture of you. May I ask, did you go through the photo archive a lot to get the memories? Because there are some photos on the front.
I have a daughter who is interested in photography and all aspects of photography. And she has taken over the photographs. And we collected photographs as a family. So she sorted them out and copied them in and did all the things that you have to do as a photographer. And she's maintained reference to all the pictures that we've used in the book. She and I together looked at them, but I'm slightly handicapped at the moment with eyesight problems. And so it was necessary to rely entirely on Sally.
Well, let's take the listener on your journey. And take me on the journey as well, because I'm looking forward to this. So tell me a little bit about your childhood. From what I've read so far, and I'm not all the way through the book, but what I've read so far, it was predominantly a happy childhood.
It was a very happy childhood. I was born on a farm to a farmer's, and my mother was a townie, but they set up on a farm, and I was born there near Perth.
And were both parents Scottish?
Both parents were Scottish, and my father played cricket for Perthshire, and our Saturdays were made up of looking at cricket matches in various parts of Perthshire. Cricket was a big idea then, because you got as many as 10,000 on the North Inch, which every Saturday.
And just for the people that aren't aware of the area that we're in, the Inch is a large expanse of playing field, isn't it, in Perth,
yes,
in Scotland?
There are two. Well, it's a joke. Perth is the town between 2 inches, and that's the size of it, because there's the North Inch and the South Inch.
And there would be literally thousands of people...
10,000.
...going to watch cricket every Saturday, which was a big, big day for your family.
Oh, it was, because Dad was a very good cricketer up to Scotland level, and he spent a lot of his time in his 30s and 20s on the cricket pitch.
You did.
And so I was introduced to sport very early on.
I was going to say, you did say before we started recording, maybe he played a bit more cricket and not too much on the farm.
Yes, although it was a very good farm, and it's still in operation today. And he got to it too young to manage it properly. But then the economic situation of the 30s also had its effect, and farmers didn't do too well at that time. And so he lost his job on that farm. That farm was taken back and then sold off by the owner. It was a tenant farmer we had.
And then that subsequently meant that you moved to England with the family.
Well, finally, Dad got a job, and it was in Reading. And this was a total shock to my system, because I would be about 7, 8. And one morning at breakfast, Dad announced that we would be leaving. And I thought we were on that farm for life. I thought that's what people did, that it didn't move. Farmers in particular, it didn't move. But we did.
So how I know the news must have been a shock, but can you remember how you reacted that morning?
Yes, I can remember it very well, because I was drinking milk at the time, and I was sure that the milk turned sour in my mouth when he said it, because I couldn't believe it. I just could not believe it. And moving to the south of England was even more of a shock, because I had to change schools, we had to change neighbours, we had to adapt to a different way of life altogether. And we did.
And was Reading quite welcoming to the family?
Yes, Reading was very, I went to a very good school, which is still in operation, and they set the kind of set of values that my parents were looking for me. And I'd come from a good school in Crieff, but it wasn't the same as the one in Reading. And so the one in Reading was the major part of my middle school career. And the main saving grace that there was that I learned to play hockey.
I was reading a little bit as well, and you didn't realise how tough it was for your parents in terms of finance until you inherited your mother's letters some years later?
Yes, that's quite right. A long time later, because money didn't come into it as far as I was concerned. We were on a farm. It was well-to-do in terms of money. You just lived, and you didn't think about how you lived. You just did it. And so I was dealing with the fact that we were moving, that was enough. And it was only later that money came into it when I was going to college in Bedford as a PE teacher. And I had to pay for that, of course. And where would the money come from when we didn't have any at that time? But I didn't know we didn't have any. It was only when I was an 18, 19-year-old going into college that we went to see the other side of the family business, which was in Bathgate. And it was a big first supermarket, I should think, in Scotland, because it occupied the whole of one street in Bathgate with groceries and vegetables, anything that you needed in a household, had it.
Was that on your mum's side or your dad's side?
My mum's side.
Right.
My mum had a family there, and they strolled throughout West Lothian, because they had 22... outlets in West Lothian.
Wow.
And so it was a big business. And there were 5 children of my grandfather who started the business. And they took over 4 sons and 2 daughters, 4 sons and 2 daughters. And my mother went to see her eldest brother and sold her shares in the business against her father's wishes, but she got her money to educate me and my brother, both through college and through school.
Wow. That's another story altogether.
And that is another story. It is another story. The Walker story would be something that I have in mind, which I have actually, because I've already written the biography of my mother before she was married, and my father before he was married, because they both did interesting things. So that is still to come.
So Reading is where your love of your beloved game of hockey came about. Is that
yes?
Right?
Well,
that
we had sport in the school. It was made quite important, and therefore it helped to integrate this Scottish incomer that I was in the classroom as well, which was a great help.
Did you feel that there was a divide when you went down? I mean, you talked about, you mentioned the phrase Scottish incomer there. Did you feel that there was a divide between North and South at that point?
No, the atmosphere was very welcoming and the teaching was excellent. But I had made friends quite quickly, mainly in my own class or in the senior classes where I was put in the first 11 and came round to sport again, and I mixed with the seniors then. And so I kept a friendship with some of the people that I met then as children now, which is quite a good record.
We'll come back to hockey in just a moment, because I know that when we ask about your achievements, there's a certain achievement that brings a smile to my face. But we'll come back to that.
Right.
But if we can fast track slightly, because I want to take the listener from Reading. What brought you back up to Scotland?
Well, what brought us back up to Scotland was the war, because 1935-36 was getting. That's when we went to Reading. And the war was 1939, and so we waited to see what was happening, because my father then had a job in Reading, and we had to spend every night in an air raid shelter, and it was becoming a dangerous place to be, because although Reading wasn't particularly zapped by the Germans entirely, it was when London was bombed, Reading was bombed too. So my father, they debated, both of them, mum and dad, whether we should go to America, as a number of people that we knew had evacuated to, or whether we should stay put, or what we should do, because he was conscious of it being a very dangerous place to stay and he wanted us to have a life. So he looked into all these options, and then he made up his mind what it was that we were to do, and we were to go back to Bathgate and stay there until he got a job in Perthshire. Mm-hmm. So we went back, and he got a job in Crieff.
And for many, many people of a younger generation, I'm sure, because I certainly can't fathom what it would have been like on a dark night with bombs dropping, being in a shelter, covering yourself from the enemy, living on rations. Because all we see really is sometimes a romanticised version on films, and I'm sure it wasn't anything like that, the romantic version of the way that it's being portrayed sometimes.
Yeah,
in films.
It wasn't particularly frightening. We were told by the school, we kept our, one thing we did have with us was our gas masks. We had to carry them about with you. So that was a reminder constantly that we were at war. And then the planes that were shot down were posted up in number every day in the school, so that you knew how many planes had been lost in the Battle of Britain.
On both sides?
Mm, both sides. And so we knew what was going on, but we had a life as well. I remember going to a shop in Reading, because it had a chocolate ration deposited there and we could go and buy a piece of chocolate if we wanted to.
So was it mum and dad that kept that normality, or was it something that was driven by the government propaganda machine at the time?
Probably. Films, for example, would be propaganda past, if you like. But we didn't know that. They were just films. Mrs. Miniver.
Oh, yes, yes, yeah, I've seen that film.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That was a film which just springs to mind. That's what my memory does for me. I'm lucky, considering my handicaps, I'm lucky to have a very clear memory of what happened. And all the episodes in the book come straight out of my head. I didn't do any research at all for it.
And handwritten, of course.
And it was handwritten. And it's strange because what the stroke that I suffered has left me with is eyesight deficiency. I can see some things, but not all. And writing, I could write, but I couldn't read it back to myself. That sounds a strange thing to say, because I couldn't then edit it. So I have another daughter, Sally, who has been brilliant in editing, in doing the seeing things that had to be done, in having a laptop and having, you know, all those things. So I couldn't have done it without her. But I'd always written anyway beforehand, so maybe it was punched into my memory.
Well, Sally and Shona are through the glass there, just keeping a watchful eye on me, making sure that I behave myself. So we're back in Scotland. What did Mum and Dad do when they got back in terms of a job?
Well, they didn't do anything, really. Dad did. He had a job. That was the norm, that the moneymaker in the family had the job, that the wives, the women, had no job because that wasn't the fashion. And when I got married in 1950, it was still like that. I moved into a Dunfermline, which I didn't know before, and the expectation of me as a newly married bride in 1950 was stay at home. I didn't want just to sit there and be a bride. I wanted to sit and do something. So I did what I could, which was various friends of mine who had full-time jobs and when they were single would invite me to take classes in the school and augment their staff for the time being. And then I was going to have a family, and that was the end of any work. My work time was taken up with looking after the children, and I had five of them, and it was great. But I had help as well. It wasn't all hard work. By any means, it wasn't hard work. And it's been brilliant ever since.
And all the while you were bringing up family, were you still... I know you're a very sporty family, but were you still playing hockey at the time?
No, I stopped playing hockey dead. I stopped it when I was still in the team. I was in the team when I was 19, and I stayed until I was 22, 23.
And you were part of the team that beat England in...
No, I was not in the playing team. I was the coach.
Right.
And therefore, I was in control. And the coach had, had to make it your own because I hadn't been a coach before. And I had ideas that I wanted to exploit.
Because this was a particular high in your life, wasn't it? Scotland, the team that you were coaching, the hockey team,
yes,
that beat England for the first time in, what, 40 years?
40 years. That was the sort of aim for people who were employed as internationalists. That was the big one, because 65,000 children, or mainly children, were at Wembley, and Wembley was the peak. And so if you were in a team that was being looked at for international duty, then you wanted it to have a name. And the coach's job is to spell out the aim for the team, and they must all be working together.
Now, this is really interesting because there you are at Wembley, Scotland, the coach.
Yeah.
And the English think that they're going to get their way and beat Scotland.
Yes.
But you had a plan. You had a trick up your sleeve.
Yes, I had.
In terms of how to play the game.
Yes.
Tell us, share that, because I love this story. Share your strategy with us.
Right. Well, my strategy was to look at other games. Initially, I had to review what my targets would be as a coach when I was offered the post. I didn't actually apply. They offered it to me. Partly, I think, sorry, this is a digression, partly because I wrote for a paper for the 10 years.
For the Scotsman?
Mm-hmm, the Scotsman, for 10 years in the sports column once a week. And so I could say what I liked, and I did. And so I was coaching and saying what it was I was aiming at the same time. So the team also was a dream team before. I could see the potential in the team.
But you decided to look at other sports and apply that,
yes,
to a new way of,
yes,
playing hockey, wasn't,
yes,
it?
For example, when I was appointed, and I accepted it because it was a prestigious posting, really, in my eyes, and it was a position of authority and I could make changes, although they were not altogether popular with administrators who wanted the status quo and wanted to just dodge along, especially in England, because they'd been successful. Why would they change? But in order to break it up, I had to change Scotland considerably. And it was in keeping with the European ideas as well. It wasn't entirely my own thought, but this was in football. And so I wrote a book about it.
So it's basically, you'd said to the team and coached the team to apply the same tactics a football team would play for that of hockey.
And you're England, quite right.
England had no idea what to do.
No.
They did not know how to fend you off.
No, they didn't know what to do in that particular game because you were adjusting your coaching tactics to the game that they played. So playing against Holland, playing against Germany, playing against England were all different. And so you had to carry your... It was made a much more interesting game than just the same hit and run, which it was.
And while we accept that the game of hockey has changed since then, and probably since then again,
yes,
it is fair to say that your strategy changed the face of the game, not only in Scotland, but in other parts of the world. Don't be modest.
Well, I think that is the case, because if I watch a game today, I recognise what they're doing because that's what I would have done too. Now, that's a long time ago. So it's probably needing an overview now as it did then. Perhaps they've overdone the change of rules. Perhaps they've gone too far in the strategies that they had. But Scotland could do better. That's another thing, of course. You want to get the players to play to their best ability, not just go on the field and play. You had to do better than that in my book.
So this is where I want to get to with this, because you've hit the nail on the head. As a coach, you're a leader. And the theme throughout this series of 12 podcasts is around leadership.
Yes.
And about the qualities and the skills and the attributes that one needs.
That's
in
right.
Order to be a good leader. What do you think they are? Because I doubt they've changed over the past 40 years.
No, I don't suppose they have, really, because it works well. People are people and they're interested in themselves. The hockey, any team game, we could talk about team games as well, any team game is made up of individuals. And so you've got to apply to the individual before you can get the collective. And once you've got them interest in them, you make sure that they will take praise as well as criticism. You don't go marching in and knock the heads together. You might feel like it, but you don't do it. And so the basic phenomena, I suppose, when you first meet a team, is to respect that they have something to say as well. You're not necessarily going to change to it, but you can listen to it. So as a coach, you're a listener as well as a talker. And you don't just shout at the odds at your team from the sideline as some of the football people do. And that doesn't get through to players who resent being shouted at anyway when they're playing their best and they don't know what to do next because the coach hasn't prepared the way to do what she's shouting about now.
What about when people aren't playing at their best, whether that's in sport or in business? What does one do to change that performance of that individual and then subsequently the team?
Well, it's quite difficult because if they're underperforming, they're usually dropped from selection altogether. If the coach is any good, she wouldn't include them. And perhaps she doesn't agree with that, and so there's dissension. I think that the coach has to remind all the players that there is a team here, not just you, and you can contribute to the team off the pitch as much as, not as much, but you can contribute to the well-being of the team and the atmosphere and how you take it, because all the players are watching each other's reactions. And if you have managed to instill a cooperation between the players, then your quid's in.
Are you a tough person? Are you a tough leader?
No. I think I could honestly say no. I persuade. I try and reason. I try to see the other side of the coin, so that it's two sides to one issue.
But you've made unpopular decisions in the past, so maybe I should change the word from tough to resilient.
Well, I particularly in view of this interview, which is brilliant, by the way, I have noticed that my early life has been involved in constant change. Now, at the time, I was a toddler, I was a middle school and so on, I didn't notice it. You did what Mum and Dad did. You didn't think of questions. You might have been upset by what they did, but you wouldn't necessarily rebel against it, because after all, they were your mum and dad. That was your respect, and teachers you respect, and professors even when you get to university you respect. And so that governs how you manage things, I think.
Do you know, I've got to say, Mary, there's a whole series we could do with you, but I'm trying very hard to keep on track.
Oh,
with,
sorry.
No, it's not you, it's me, because I've got 101 different questions going through my head. So it's me, but I'm going to go back because there are other stuff that I would love to ask you.
Right.
But I really get the leadership stuff, and I think there's a lot that you've spoken about there that can be equated to business leadership as well. Absolutely. One of the toughest questions I've asked of all my guests so far, and there's just a few more questions I want to go through, if you don't mind, Mary.
No,
is,
not at all.
We all go through dark times.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't matter who we are.
Mm-hmm.
There are times when we hit a dark place. And I just wondered whether you would be happy to share with me and the listener a time where you've been in a dark space or place and how you've come out the other side.
Yes. Well, I've been very fortunate in my life that there haven't been very many dark places. But inevitably, events that happen affect you. And I suppose the dark place was when my cousin was killed in the war. The cousin I had had a very close relationship with in Bathgate during my childhood, and he was 3 years older than me, and he was killed in the war. And that was a major, I couldn't believe it. And we didn't even know how he'd been killed for a long time, not until years later when I visited his grave in Belgium. But that was a major dark spot, which was interestingly, looking back on it, coped with was silence. We didn't talk about it. I was at college at the time and came back for a holiday in Christmas, the Christmas break, and found out when I got home that it had happened. And his parents, one of them would talk to adults, not me. And so that set the scene on how you were to behave, because you had to respect how they wanted it, because they were the nearest. Nobody looked at me, except because if you didn't look at it, it wasn't really happening, was it?
And was that a typical coping mechanism of the time, do you think, or was that just...
Oh, I think it was.
Yeah.
There was no counselling, there was no discussion, there was no... until we went to Belgium that much later, and then it was, I suppose, safer. You got used to it yourself.
And when you went to Belgium
and
you saw your cousin's grave, was there a... What went through your mind? What was the feeling?
Well, it was always disbelief, really. He'd been home on leave and then had gone back and was actually killed in a motor accident with British officers, which made it worse because it wasn't in war, as it were.
Do you think that if it had been spoken about at the time, would acceptance of your cousin's death become would acceptance come sooner, or have you never accepted it?
Oh yes, I think I have accepted it, but maybe in the room next door, you know, that kind of feeling. It comes up all from time to time, probably in connection with other deaths and funerals and things like that, or his birthday, and you know.
Thank you for sharing that. I appreciate that.
That's all right.
We are going to cheer things up now.
Oh, good.
We are going to cheer things up. And we're just going to talk about a time where, on the opposite side, you've had a time that was dark, but a time that you've been elated, a time that you went, wow, does it get any better than this?
Well, there are so many, really, because, as I say, I had a happy life. I suppose... We'll skip Wembley because that was certainly a high. I mean, that was a big achievement in a lot of people's books. I mean, there were 64,000 there who would go away and remember it because it was an unusual ending. So that was one. Another one was my PhD, I suppose. That was amazing.
When did you study and achieve that?
I was about 60.
Okay.
Because I did a master's first. My college principal was... The things have... In my life, I have discovered that everything falls for me. I don't have to do anything. I just sit there and it happens, which is amazing. And everything I've done... the sort of things that you might not do at that stage have fallen right and have been quite good for me, and perhaps hopefully good because there was the counselling bit, which I went into and was 20 years on the college staff as a student counsellor. And that was an achievement too over a period, because they hadn't got student councillors when I started. I was the first one again.
So was this seen as a new fandangled thing?
Absolutely.
Wow, OK.
So it was great, because in a way I could see where the principal was coming from, because I did have a PE connection, being a graduate. I was a games player, therefore I understood about the students' games. I had done a counselling course and had done various positions that demanded counselling and so on. So those are the sort of high points, really, because I found that every 10 years of my life was different to the previous one. That was easy to write the book, because it fell naturally into decades.
And staying with decades, one of my standard questions for my guests, we talk about technology, and the question usually goes, over the past 30 years, technology has changed dramatically. Over the past 90 years, I would imagine that...
Oh, absolutely.
It's been mind-blowing. So, you know, for the future, does the growth and the rise in the popularity of technology, does that worry you for the future, or is it something that you think is we should grasp wholeheartedly and just run with?
Well, I think it's a bit of both. I think that you can go too far in technology and it cuts out the personal input. And in this life, it's people that matter, not things.
We're going to come on to your chosen tune in just a moment. And as I said, we could probably do a 5-hour podcast with all this. However, time is tight. The fact that you're here is invaluable for me, for the podcast, and the fact that somebody's listening to this. You are without doubt, and it is a fact, you know, the most mature person that we've had on the series. And probably with that brings a wealth of experience. If you could give one bit of advice, either personal or professional, that you have acquired or learnt over your 90 years, and something that we could benefit from, what would it be, Murray? It's a toughie. It is a toughie, but I'm just, you know, the ultimate.
Recognition of, well, what I've just said, really. Recognition of people's reactions, their point of view, all these sorts of things. Love, in fact. We haven't mentioned love, and love is a big deal in my life.
So ultimately, what we're saying is don't lose sight of love and respect.
Exactly.
As we wrap up, has music played a large part in your life as well? As maybe not as much as sport or hockey, but has it been there?
It's been there. When it came to teamwork, there was always a very interesting piece of music that followed me around, particularly on a visit to South Africa, where I was being accepted as a visitor, and it was Mary's Wedding, the Scottish tune. That was the song.
The chosen song to wrap up the podcast,
yes,
is Mary's Wedding.
Yes.
And that is because of those memories. But Mary, it's been an absolute pleasure having you in studio. Your book, The Times of My Life, is out now, ukbookpublishing.com. The Times of My Life, Dr. Mary Weir. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much indeed for having me.
The Made in Scotland podcast, sponsored by Ogilvy Ross, was produced by Chris Kidd for Goddine Studios and GRC.